Welcome to The Divorce Social with me, Samantha Baines, changing the conversation around divorce. This show is sponsored by Penguin in the Room. Penguin in the Room is an award-winning arts marketing and social media management company. If you want to jazz up your socials and have someone Instagram and tweet for you, then here's your answer. Go to www.penguinintheroom.com. As always, hit subscribe to make sure you're updated about new episodes. And we love to hear from you on social media at DivorcePod and at Samantha Baines. You can also email us. All the info's on our website, thedivorcesocial.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I am joined by Stephen Petro, author of Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old and columnist of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hello. So nice to be with you today.
Thanks for joining us. Welcome to The Divorce Social.
I think I'm pleased to be at The Divorce Social. I am divorced. I guess I qualify.
Well, maybe you could give us a judgment of whether you're pleased to be here at the end.
Okay.
You are divorced. How does me saying that make you feel?
You know, I've been divorced for about 4 years now, and I think had we been doing this then, I would have felt a sense of weight, a sense of failure. I would not have felt good. But I've sort of come a long way in my own growth around that word, around that concept. You know, as a gay man, I never expected in this lifetime to get married, and I certainly never expected to be a divorcee, that would be with one E, I guess.
Does that prey on your mind, I guess, the fact that you never expected to be married and now you're divorced?
It did prey on my mind. Now I understand it more as sort of the two sides of equality. And so LGBTQ people who fought for many, many years, decades, to have the right to be married, part and parcel with that comes the right to become divorced and the obligation to go through the legal process just as any other couple would. And that's as it should be, even though it's a painful process, for sure.
I read a brilliant article you wrote about your divorce process, and in it you said, "I get to get divorced." And talking about that right and that equality of, yeah, you have the equality of being able to get married, but you also have the equality of getting divorced. And you talk in your article that a divorce is the same whether you're two men, two women, a man and a woman, you know, whatever your situation, all the laws are the same. Was that quite a revelationary process for you during the divorce, or is that not something you thought about at the time?
It wasn't really something I thought about at the time because it sort of happened, and it happened quickly, and I did not really have a distance view of what was going on. I was sort of suddenly faced with a number of very difficult decisions. Where was I going to live? Did I want to move back to California where I came from? How was I going to afford things? Health insurance, all of these really practical matters, as well as in this country, trying to come to a legal separation agreement and so on and so forth. So really caught up in the details to start off with. And it only was really a year or so later that I had some perspective and began to understand, in a way, the historic nature of same-sex couples becoming divorced and how that fits into the equality notion, you know, and facing many of the same challenges that opposite-sex couples have for a long time. And then actually, I became irritated too, not with my ex, but I became irritated with some of my friends who refer to what was happening as, oh, you and Jim, you broke up, you split up. And as one who writes about language and the meaning of language, those didn't seem to be the right words to describe the dissolution of a marriage. And I don't remember sort of using them with my straight friends who were getting divorced. Oh, I'm so sorry you split up. In a way, I think it delegitimizes the nature of that institution and the relationship. So I was a little irritable too.
Let's go back to the beginning of your experience. So when was that moment for you that you decided to break up and get divorced? What was that catalyst moment?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to be a little vague about this because my family would prefer that. But about a year before, a relative of ours acknowledged that he had been having a long-term affair and had been married all that time. And I remember when I asked him, well, how come you never got divorced? He said, I never found the right time. And I sort of packed that away and said, I do not want to get to my 80s and to have perhaps had a clandestine affair for a long time and to say, I never found the right time. So I kind of made a promise to myself. It was around the time of my 59th birthday to either be moving ahead with the divorce or to be recommitted into the relationship. And then it was about 6 or 7 months later that we separated.
It's interesting that I'd never had the right time to get divorced. Is there a right time to get divorced, do you think?
I don't think there's a right time. I think every time is a very hard time. And you can always find a reason to postpone it. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, I had made a plan to talk to my ex about leaving in early January of 2017. And I had consulted a lawyer and I had, not emotionally, but I understood otherwise what the road ahead was and I had a plan. And that very afternoon, I got a call from the hospice nurse who was taking care of my mom in New York. And she said, your mother is now unresponsive. You know, she will pass in 24 to 48 hours. You should come up here, which I did. So I left. Yet another reason not, you know, to postpone, but that was you know, a very immediate one. And then my mom died the next day and I was with her and that was as it should have been. And then I actually said to myself, well, I need to take a little breather from all of this. This is one huge loss and I don't know that I'm ready now to proceed with the separation. But sometimes things are not in our control. And then about a month later, he came to me and said he was leaving. And so that then precipitated things and we were then sort of off to those races.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. My father actually died while we were engaged, but before we were married. Mm-hmm. So I had my wedding day without my dad there and cried when I put my wedding dress on. And I think for me, that death of a parent made me suddenly reevaluate who I was, where I was, what I wanted. And also that life is short. And maybe that comes into that time to get divorced, is that I suddenly realized that time was finite. Do you think that losing your mother had an effect on the process? It sounds like it would have happened anyway, but what effect do you think it had going through grief at the same time as such a big breakup of a marriage?
So I'll just add in one other event on the timeline, which is then a month after we separated, my father died.
My goodness.
So I had these three losses in the first 100 days of 2017. And I will say, Samantha, that what was challenging for me was separating the different threads of grief, because basically I was overwhelmed. They all got mixed together. I had a very difficult time processing them. And I think each one probably would have been a significant enough loss to need some focus, you know, some therapy and so on. But the three of them interwoven, I'll just say it, it really knocked me off my feet.
Wow. I can't imagine going through those three things at once. And particularly, I've spoken to people who've lost both parents and they talk about that feeling of then being an orphan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the loneliness that comes with that. And of course, with the breakup of a marriage, there's loneliness that comes with that. Did you feel that particularly strongly? And how did you deal with those feelings?
Well, I did. And actually, I remember writing a column for the Washington Post about becoming what I called an adult orphan at the age of 59 or 60. And, you know, how odd that felt. And, you know, I get, you know, it wasn't like I had anywhere near like a perfect relationship with my parents. But without them, the way I have thought about it was, in a sense, they were the North Star in my constellation. And things just sort of gravitated in that direction. And then when they were no longer there, I felt like my compass was spinning around a lot. And then, you know, with my marriage unfolding, I think the compass was speeding up in its twirl. And I did some healthy things. I did some unhealthy things. You know, I pressed ahead with the therapy that I was in. I focused on self-care. I really doubled down on a meditation practice and a gratitude practice. And actually, it's probably the gratitude practice that gave me the greatest amount of solace. And so every day when I woke up, I wrote three things that I was grateful for in a little book. And then when I went to bed, I wrote three things that I was grateful for. And they could be, you know, it could be like, it was a beautiful day to, I had a piece of dark chocolate. I mean, it big and small, but in an accumulative way, this notation of gratitude started to lift me, but it was a very gradual way. You know, and I relied on friends a lot.
I love that idea of noting gratitude at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, because I have anxiety. So I take medication for anxiety. So I try and meditate as well. But sometimes, I don't know about you, but for me, when something bad happens, it spirals in my head because of my anxiety to be like the worst thing in the world. So like everything is awful. Nothing's, you know, going to be okay again. And actually, yeah, just like I really enjoyed a piece of chocolate today, like can really make a difference. So I love the idea of writing that down as a kind of way of recovery. But you said you did some good things. We talk about therapy a lot on this podcast, and I, you know,
shocking,
had therapy.
Shocking.
Yeah, I've had therapy for everything that's happened to me at this point. And we're still peeling the layers of the onion with my therapist. But you said you did some bad things. I don't know if you want to go into that, but I always talk a lot about my sexual explosion. And obviously it wasn't all bad, but I got divorced, went out and had a lot of sex and good times and partying. And a lot of that was great, but obviously I finally realized that maybe I was covering up for some underlying feelings with that situation. Is there anything that you feel that you could talk about that you kind of did that maybe wasn't meditating and grateful practices?
So I did not do that one. I felt very damaged. I was very emotional. I did not think I would be a good sexual or intimate partner. And I basically just postponed all of that for a year until I felt that I had become more whole, and then kind of stepped in very gradually. But what I did that was not so healthy, it's not nearly as interesting, Samantha, I'm sorry.
So please share. The sex wasn't always interesting either,
I know,
to be honest.
I withdrew, and that's a natural tendency of mine. I do suffer from depression and anxiety as well. And so I withdrew because that was kind of a place that I knew and a place that I felt that it was safe and I wouldn't be further hurt. I would not recommend withdrawing to myself again. And it's a tendency that I fight as I sort of deal with successive waves of depression as I often do. And just recently I have been in one of those sort of low periods, and I have made a point of telling certain friends, this is where I am now, and not trying to camouflage that, there have been some times when I haven't been able to, haven't felt well enough to go to an event or to dinner. And instead of just making up a lie, I've said, my depression is getting the better of me and I need to hang back. And in a way, that has made me feel more connected to those people whom I trust and, you know, who understand.
Yeah, I think honesty is always the answer, isn't it? Although sometimes it's very hard to be honest with the people around you about how you're feeling. I can definitely relate to that sort of just put a brave face on it. Everything's fine. You're just not seeing me because I'm busy, but actually.
Right. And I'm often very busy and I used to be traveling a lot. So I had sort of convenient excuses, but I am trying in these years to be more authentic, more honest with myself and with others. And I do find that overall that brings me greater intimacy, either in a friendship way or, in another way.
And do you remember a particular low moment during that whole time? Because a lot of people I find listen to this podcast during maybe one of those low moments. And it's hard to imagine that everyone has them and that everyone comes out of them again. And I talk a lot about crying face down on my kitchen floor and having dislocated my knee, just staring out the window, feeling like life was crashing down around me.
You know, I think the lowest point was moving out of the house that we had bought together and that we had lived in. And then, so physically it was exhausting and emotionally it was exhausting. And then right about that same time, my ex announced on Facebook that he was in a new relationship. So that was about two months after we'd separated. And that was hard. That was hard.
And I think a lot of people be able to relate to that kind of their other half getting a partner first and announcing it to the world. How did that feel? And how did that moment hit you physically? Did you say you saw it on Facebook?
Some friends of mine saw it on Facebook and then they said, oh, go look on his Facebook page. I guess we were still Facebook friends at that point. Then just because of the shortness of time, I saw people who were mutual friends of ours saying, oh, did you and Steven get back together? And I was like, oh, yeah, did that happen? It was kind of this, I was incredulous. And then of course, it was real. And then I believe I defriended him. It was time. Very empowering.
Did you feel angry? Because I remember when my ex, I mean, he went straight into a new relationship like weeks later. Mm-hmm. And then that one didn't work out. And then I don't still talk to him actually, but I believe now he's in a longer term relationship. But when he started on this longer term relationship and we were still talking and he was sort of like telling me about it and I didn't like it. And it actually made me really angry. I went through an angry stage, but that specific thing of him like telling me about the relationship and him just being able to like move on so quickly when I was like trying to deal with all my layers made me really angry. I actually bought boxing gloves and an inflatable boxing thing and started boxing in the garden.
Good for you.
Did you have an angry phase?
I had an angry phase. I didn't have the angry phase at that moment because I was really just, that was probably still within weeks after my dad died. So I was just sort of emotionally drained and wasn't able to access being angry. I was surprised. And I remember we had talked not that long before when his brother had divorced and then quickly repartnered, you know, how that wouldn't allow for healing or learning. And so I did have, you know, those thoughts. Gee, that was fast. I'm not sure how quickly one can learn what there is to learn. And, and honestly, would I have preferred to have been the first one to be repartnered? Absolutely. Absolutely. But that hadn't happened. And, you know, that still hasn't happened. And that's fine in its own way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I would have preferred to be the one kind of repartnered mm-hmm. first. But then why is that? It's like I wasn't ready. I didn't want a partner at that stage. But we still want to be like win in some way.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't ready. And that was when I was taking my very defined hiatus of a year before even dating. So it would have been hard to get partnered or married again without even going on a date. So, I think it's just part of the emotional response. You know, now it's 4 years later and they are married and I am happy for them because I understand that they are happier, he is happier, and I am happier. And that's a good place to have wound up in.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm the same. Looking back now, I'm a few years on, I'm like, you know, well, good on them if they can find happiness, and I'm much happier out of that relationship. So great. So you said you left everything kind of dating wise for a year. When you went into that world, how did that feel? Because I hadn't done dating apps before. And then all of a sudden it was swipe central.
Right. So it had been 14 years. And so I got back into the swing of it 2017 or 2018. So there were no apps when I had last been single. I had been on Match.com, which is about it. So yes, an entirely new world to understand, to navigate, emojis, acronyms. It was foreign. Yeah, I also found it like this whole new terrain. And I'll say initially I thought, oh, I'm looking to replicate the kind of relationship I had with the kind of person that I had. But as I went a little bit further, I then said to myself, oh, I don't know if I should be so quick about trying to replicate what I had. That didn't work out. And I'm a different person now than I was 14 years ago. And so perhaps I'm looking for different things. And that led to a period of, you know, really experimenting, meeting all kinds of different people, going out of my comfort zone, having some great experiences, having some wacky experiences. So, and that was when I was turning 60, 61. And, you know, that was not something I would have said, oh, that's going to be happening when you become a sexagenarian, which is one of my favorite words, which has nothing to do with sex, but still one of my favorite words.
It's interesting because we spoke to Paul Roseby over in the UK about his divorce from his partner and then coming back into the gay dating scene. And he said that people started calling him a daddy. And he was like, what? I don't want to be anyone's daddy. And about all the acronyms that he wasn't aware of in the LGBTQIA plus community. You know, how do you discover what an acronym means? Do you ask the person? Was there lots of Googling?
Well, I have a very good friend who was my post-divorce counselor, and he had been divorced also. So he was my guide to this new terrain, and he would explain just about everything to me. So I was like, oh, that's what that means. Oh, and he said, you know, yes, you are a daddy. And there are different kinds of daddies. They're generous daddies. Those are the daddies who pay for everything. You know, then they're the daddies who say they're not generous, and which sounds so cheap, but it is what it is.
So is that the terminology? You say, I am not a generous daddy on your profile.
I don't actually say that, but I see many people will say, you know, who are of a certain age, my age, who have gray hair or whatever, they will say not generous.
So if you didn't know what that meant, you'd just be like, why are you telling me one of your faults?
Well,
you're not
exactly
a generous person.
That was one of my initial questions. Why are they asking me that? I am by nature a generous person.
I'd be so confused in that scenario. I'd be like, why is no one generous on this app? What's going on?
But one thing I did write about in my book is how I lied about my age at the beginning. I was on the cusp of 60, or I was 60, and I remained 58 or I remained 59 because I really didn't want the stigma or the perceived stigma of being 60. And then I kind of felt uncomfortable telling, you know, a white lie. It wasn't that many years. And I met up online with a friend I had gone to college with so we went to college. We were the same age. He was now 10 years younger. He was just turning 50. And I was like, whoa, that's so big. That's such a big stretch. And I said, well, how does that work out for you? You know, when do you tell the truth? And he said, well, I use it to get in the door. And then I will tell them on the first date. And half the time they just walk. And the other half of the time, you know, we proceed. And he said, well, those are good odds for me. So, but at that point I decided I was going to move towards being my real age, and have done that and really found that it does not make a difference, because the younger guys who are looking for a daddy, I'm a daddy at 58, or whether I'm 64, for someone who wants an individual who's age appropriate, I'm age appropriate at either age. And if I was deemed too old, it didn't matter. You know, I'm not too old at either age. I'm just, you know, I'm 64 on the apps and I'm good with that.
Because I think a lot of people have this fear when they come out of a divorce or even a long-term relationship and go back into dating, that they're now so much older than they were the last time they were single. So want to do the fibbing about the age. When you were lying about your age, did you feel like you had to act a certain, were you like super, because I feel like I'd be like, oh, what clothes would a 25-year-old wear? Because I'm 34. So I'd be like so worried about it the whole time and like seem like I have to have more energy when I get there so they don't think I'm older than I am.
The number of years that I stretched it was 3. So it really did not impact my behavior or anything like that. I did think a little bit, oh, when does that mean I graduated from college and some of those details. But I did also have a practice of when I met someone the first time, I did say, you know, this is my real age. Or if I was going to meet them, I would be upfront about that. And that was just sort of a needless complication. And I remember somebody called me out for lying. It's like, okay, I'm just going to be straightforward about this. It's too complicated.
I love that that shows the difference in us. I'm the actress in me is like, how am I going to act younger? Whereas the wordsmith and the kind of researcher and columnist in you is like, I need to work out the facts in case anyone questions me about my history.
But also, it sounds like you were making, you know, you had a span of 9 years. You were suddenly 25. And that would, if I had lopped off a third, I would have been, you know, in my 40s, and that would have taken a lot of thinking about my clothes and so on and so forth.
Well, I like that you're back to your truthful age.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's the ad break, so it's a perfect time to remind you to hit subscribe to be notified about more episodes. You can also leave us a lovely review because honestly, it makes a difference to the chart positions. And one time I was in the charts next to Michelle Obama and I was really thrilled about it. So it'd be nice to do that again. You can also join in the conversation on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DivorcePod. We have a website, thedivorcesocial.com, and you can also join us for our like 90s style divorce chat room experience over on Patreon. So just go to patreon.com/SamanthaBaines, B-A-I-N-E-S, and it starts at £2 a month and we all have lovely and awful and amazing chats. See you there. Because I write children's books. I wanted to ask you how you think you reacted to, well, not just the divorce, a period of real hardship and lots of grief in your life as a writer. Do you think, because obviously you have a few books to your name and your most recent book, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. Do you think books were a reaction or writing was a way to help you get out of things? Or did you not write for a period of time?
I did not write for a period of time. I'd say it was probably 3 to 5 months. I was just completely shut down. And I remember one of my editors called me and said, "It's okay. I understand where you are, and we'll be here, you know, when you're ready again." A lot of the writing that I've done, whether this book or the columns, I write first person narrative, and I often talk about issues in my life. So I've then wound up writing a fair amount about my mother's death, and then my father's, and the grief that came after that, as a way, in a sense, there, it's a therapy for me to try to understand better my feelings and then bring in other sources, other people's stories, because I certainly don't have any kind of stranglehold on those themes. And so, for instance, it's not actually that long ago, I wrote a column in the Washington Post about grief, and talked about how terrified I had been before these losses of that pain and of what I'd seen in the world when people died, this abundance of emotion and pain. But one thing I had come to experience with my own grief around those losses was, in the way that that feeling stays inside of you, that's a way that individual stays inside of you too, a way that you can feel connected to someone you loved. And it's not the same, but I found it, sort of by changing my perspective on it, comforting, rather than destructive in some way. And that was really an insight I only came to, I think, 3 or 4 months ago, as I sort of continued to engage with grief and loss.
What's it like now? Because I know, having written books myself, and as I said, mine are children's books, so they're shorter. But I know writing a book is a big endeavor and takes up a lot of your life and time and emotion. How does it feel having a book out now and not having all of those emotional structures in place, like your marriage and your other half to support you and your parents to support you? Is there a freedom in that of, you were terrified you couldn't do it, but now you've done it and you're fine? Or do you miss those people being able to share the experience with you?
I guess two thoughts come to mind. And the first is, I remember when I got this box of books, it was the first time I was actually seeing the book. And I don't know if this is true in the UK, but it's become a thing among authors here that you'd kind of do the reveal. You get your box cutter and you open the box and, then you hold up the book like this. Oh my gosh, I have a book. And like this is my baby. But I remember thinking in that moment that I had come quite a distance to be able to be holding the book beyond what I would normally, when what I felt when other books have been published, but that I had traversed this land of pitfalls and emotional minefields to be able to get to that point. And that was very affirming. And then I felt a sadness that my parents were not here to enjoy that success, because they'd always been supportive and they would have loved that. And I often feel like when I was on tour for a while or doing events, that especially my mother was present. And I've loved reading stories that incorporate my mother, because my parents are actually very big players in this book. So they would have had a lot to say about it too. So I guess in some ways it's just as well that they're not looking over my shoulder, but I really have missed them in this process.
It's funny because I remember my book launch for my first children's book was after my dad had died. And mm-hmm. just after I'd got divorced. So I'd been writing the book when I was still married. And so I remember that book launch, newly, I don't think I was even officially divorced then, but newly kind of single without a husband there to kind of calm me down before everyone arrived mm-hmm. to tell me that people were going to arrive. And then my family being there, and my dad had always been, the life and soul of the party and host with the most. And that's why I think maybe I take a little bit of that from him. But I remember my mum sort of like buying everyone a round of Prosecco to kind of bring my dad into things, because that's what he would, even though there were, you know, there was the wine and the beer complimentary, but, you know, like as a kind of celebratory thing. And it's funny, those moments where they're kind of not there. But I did mention my ex in my speech, and because he did encourage me to write that book, and it didn't come out until the divorce proceedings were going through. So it meant I didn't have to share any of the revenue from the book with him. So win-win.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Looking back now, you are a few years on. Mm-hmm. Have you had a moment, and maybe it's unboxing your new book, but have you had a moment where you've thought, oh, everything's going to be okay now?
I mostly live that way. As with all wounds, they heal. They heal from the inside and they take time, but I feel healed at this point. I feel whole. And I feel that's in large part because of the work that I've done and the people who've loved me and that I've been able to love back. So I am in a good place these days. Which doesn't mean I don't have bumps. I definitely have bumps, and I get frustrated with dating and with guys that flake or guys who misrepresent themselves. But I have come to sort of understand all of that is this chapter's adventure. And so when I approach it as an adventure, I'm not disappointed. When I have a specific expectation, that's when there could be troubles.
And for anyone listening who is a gay man in a marriage with a man and is feeling that sense of shame that you mentioned at the beginning about divorce, would you have any words of comfort or advice for them?
I think people who get divorced or separated, regardless of their orientation or identity, feel some sense of that. It's part of normal. So don't medicalize it. Don't think that there's something wrong with you. It's part of the bundle of feelings that come along with it. And it won't last. You'll work through it at whatever time and pace that you need. But none of these things are forever. That's certainly the optimist in me. You know, I can't guarantee that everyone will become repartnered. I can't guarantee that for myself. But I think that this process of healing does go forward. And around the same time that I got divorced, I slipped and I had this deep wound in my foot. And I remember it took so long to heal. And for the longest time, it seemed like it wasn't healing. And I would go to the doctor and she said, be patient. It's healing from the inside. And at the very end, you will see that it is healed. And that is exactly what happened. But it was a very apt metaphor. And I was impatient too.
That is a very apt metaphor. I like that. Thank you so much. It's been so great to chat. Can you remind us about your new book and where people can find it?
Yes. It is called Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old. And it's both memoir and manifesto about aging. And I tell lots of stories about myself and my parents as we sort of traversing this terrain. And it is available online at Amazon and other fine book retailers everywhere, and hopefully in London.
And where can we find you on social media and follow your writing exploits?
I have a website, and it is stephenpetro.com. And I'm going to spell that because it's always misspelled. So that's Stephen with a V and then PETROW.com. And all my social is linked from there as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
Thank you, Sam. It's a real pleasure.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Oh, hi. Thank you for listening to The Divorce Social with me, Samantha Baines. Please leave us a review. Please, please. It would be super nice. They're lovely to read. They keep me cheery and happy and keep me going. But also, it affects our listing in the podcast charts, which are very important because that's how more people find the podcast. And I'd love to help more people get through those really tough heartbreak and divorce times. And they're more likely to find us if we're higher up on the charts. So if you'd like to leave a review, I'd love you forever. You can leave them on iTunes is the big one, or most podcast platforms do them as well. I'll take all the reviews you've got to give. You can also get in contact on Twitter and Instagram at DivorcePod and at Samantha Baines. We have a website, thedivorcesocial.com, and we have a Patreon account, which means that you can support the podcast for as little as £2 a month. And it helps me with all the admin costs. It also means you have access to our 90s style divorce and heartbreak chat room. And there's lots of exclusives on there, little bits of audio that you don't get in the main podcast, and some giveaways as well. So I'd love to see you over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Samantha Baines. And please leave a review. Did I say that already? Please leave a review. Love you forever.